Many politicians are habituated to receiving hate mail or abuse, often due to some particular policy or ideology they espouse, or perhaps to their gender, ethnic identity, or sexual orientation. Giorgio Frassinetti gets a regular postcard of a different holiday destination from an anonymous individual who addresses him, if you'll forgive my translation, as "Dear Fascist Dickhead." Frassinetti believes that in his case, his identity, let alone any particular policy or ideology, is completely unimportant. The anonymous postcard sender writes not to Frassinetti qua Frassinetti, but to the office of the mayor of Predappio, the village in which Benito Mussolini was born and is buried, a key site of neo-fascist pilgrimage, and which now proposes to build and host Italy's first and only museum of fascism. On most occasions on which Frassinetti and I met, we were interrupted every half an hour or so by his mobile phone ringing, a succession of national and international news networks from the BBC to the Washington Post would be trying to secure an interview with a man whose sole claim to their attention is that he runs this comune of approximately 6,000 people. The far right map is Italy, of course. The area within which the red marked area is the region Emilia-Romagna. This, roughly speaking, is the area marked in red. There you can see Predappio, and that's a zoomed-in focus on Predappio, so a very small corner of Italy. Most of Predappio's inhabitants are agriculturalists, in fact, dispersed in that surrounding countryside. That level of media attention is striking for a place Frassinetti regularly refers to as the Chernobyl of history, for reasons I'll go on to describe. On one occasion, over lunch, between the telephone calls, Frassinetti was recounting to me, not for the first or the last time, the story of the last mayor of Predappio before the advent of fascism in 1922. It was a story I'd heard often before, not only from him, but also from other Predappiesi. The mayor in the story was, like many in this area of Italy at the time and today, a man of strong socialist ideological convictions and had links to the Italian anarchist movement. According to the story, he's supposed to have hated Mussolini with a passion, Mussolini being himself an erstwhile socialist, thinking him a traitor to the movement. Yet it came to pass, so the story goes, that with the rise of fascism, this same man became equally convinced that he'd been mistaken, and that in fact it was fascism, not socialism, that offered the best hope for the Italian working class. He became so convinced of this, in fact, that when he came to draw up his will, he stipulated in it that he be buried in a black shirt. However, he succeeded, against his own expectations, in surviving the war, unlike his fascist convictions. As the war came to a close and amidst the brutal and bloody violence that overtook this region during fighting between fascists, German soldiers, and partisans, he underwent yet another conversion and returned to his socialist roots, this one, of course, as genuinely motivated as the last. He joined the Communist Party and went on to become the vice mayor in Predappio's first democratic post-war administration. But when years later he did indeed die, and it came time to bury him, his family received an unpleasant surprise when they examined his last will and testament, for he had, of course, forgotten to change it. So he was, so the story goes, buried in his black shirt, but with the red flag draped over the coffin and the Internationale playing at the funeral. When Frassinetti tells this story, he delights in the juxtaposition of the man's strong ideological convictions with the popular trope of the Volta Gabbana, or turncoat. And in his telling, you can hear his disdain for those who think it's easy to answer George Orwell's great unanswered question of our time, what is fascism? In this paper, I propose to address a separate but related question, not what is fascism, but rather why is it that Predappiesi and others think that that question has an answer, and why is it that they keep arguing over what that answer is? Trying to define fascism is a particularly fraught endeavour. Historical and political arguments over the proper meaning and definition of fascism have been taking place since it first emerged as a phenomenon and show no immediate sign of cooling off. A range of definitions have been proffered by eminent historians of the subject in search of a so-called fascist minimum, whilst at least one prominent scholar became so frustrated by the ambiguous use of the term that he called for it to be banned from historical discourse. Orwell, in fact, in raising his great unanswered question, was making nearly the same point in concluding that quote by remarking that he'd heard the word applied to farmers, shopkeepers, social credit, corporal punishment, fox hunting, bullfighting, the 1922 committee, the 1941 committee, Kipling, Gandhi, Chiang Kai-shek, homosexuality, Priestley's broadcasts, youth hostels, astrology, women, dogs, and I do not know what else. Indeed, historians and other academics have defined fascism as, amongst other things, a class-based response to the development of socialism, a psychological phenomenon, a species of, quote, developmental dictatorship, a, quote, palingenetic form of ultranationalism, and a sort of religion masquerading as a political movement, to name only a few such definitions. Recently, these debates have become yet more fraught by, as it were, coming alive. They've moved from residing largely or entirely in the realm of scholarly journals and academic conferences, from being, as it were, intentional and about the meaning of the word, into the world which such journals and conferences aim to investigate, from the abstract to the concrete, from analysis to object, and from intention to extension. Slate magazine, for example, recently printed an excerpt from Passmore's Fascism, A Very Short Introduction, as part of an academy series on fascism, suggesting readers consult the extract to determine whether or not they were living in a fascist state. The Atlantic, noting the elusiveness of definitions of fascism, interviewed historian Robert Paxton in search of a checklist of features to assess the extent to which Donald Trump is a fascist. The pages of international news and commentary have been filled with speculation as to whether and how far France's National Front, Germany's AfD, or Austria's Freedom Party count or do not count as fascist. And the word was even in the running to be Merriam-Webster's Word of the Year in 2016. This is just a short collection of some of the news headlines concerning fascism, which reads... but it does read like a slightly disturbing question and answer session. And back to Mussolini. The problem of definition is exacerbated by a number of specific factors in the case of fascism, including the lack of any clear doctrinal text, inconsistency of practice and policy on the part of so-called fascist regimes, an apparent aversion to ideological or theoretical self-definition on the part of self-declared fascists, and the peculiar fact that fascist movements have been, of course, if they have been anything, usually ultra-nationalist in character, whilst also arguably forming an international, supranational object of some form. And all of those factors, as well as more traditional problems of definition, combine to make it extremely difficult to define fascism, whilst apparently doing nothing to dispel the appetite of historians, political scientists, journalists, commentators, and ordinary people for attempting to do so. One such attempt, written in 1995, but recently the topic of some renewed debate, is an article in the New York Review of Books by Umberto Eco, which lists many of the above problems with defining fascism and concludes, in fact, that it is an excellent example of a family resemblance term. The notion of family resemblance also recurs frequently in contemporary journalistic accounts of the rise of the far right in Europe and the US, both in arguments for the fact that Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen are in some sense parts of the same phenomenon, and for their further inclusion within the pantheon of what Eco called fascism. Eco's specific suggestion is that, like game in Wittgenstein's original argument, fascism this is a quotation, "Fascism became an all-purpose term because one can eliminate from a fascist regime one or more features and it will still be recognisable as fascist." So Eco's clearly correct that there is a sense in which fascism is indeed an all-purpose term, the same sense that makes his argument compelling for many historians and contemporary political commentators worried about its application or misapplication. But for precisely that reason, his analogy is a little misleading, because for many of the people he's addressing, for that audience of historians, political commentators, and indeed for many contemporary Predappiesian Italians, the word fascism is not in the least like the word game, in that its proper definition and application is exactly what they are concerned with. Eco's argument competes with, in other words, rather than explains, attempts at definitions of fascism. It explains the, or might explain, the pragmatics of the word in some sense, but what it certainly does is explain away why that question matters to people in the first place, the pragmatics of the semantics of fascism, if you like. And recall also that the puzzle I proposed to address in this paper was not what is fascism, but rather why do we appear so often to think that that question has an answer? Eco's argument, far from resolving that problem, intensifies its perplexing nature. If he's correct, as indeed he surely is, in asserting that fascism as a word is used in a variety of different ways by different people to mean different things and denote different objects, then it's only more peculiar that so many of those different people appear to believe that the intention and extension of the word in their usage is the only correct form of such usage, and that so many people who puzzle and have puzzled over the word puzzle over it in search of a definite answer. In the remainder of this paper, I'm going to suggest a candidate explanation for that problem, at least as it applies to my particular field site, which is, as I've already suggested in regard to fascism, a somewhat particular place. The Romagna, the region, this is Emilia Romagna. Romagna is the southeastern corner of it, roughly from Imola south, and Predappio is about. The Romagna, the region in which Predappio is situated, had existed under papal rule for centuries prior to its assimilation into the Kingdom of Italy during the Risorgimento, and it had thus cultivated a famously strong tradition of anti-clericalism. And for related reasons, also higher than average at the time of the Risorgimento and the late 19th century, were the numbers of socialist and anarchist activists prominent in the Romagna, which remains still famous today as a bastion of left-wing politics. Frassinetti, the current mayor of Predappio, is the most recent in an unbroken line of post-war left-wing mayors, and got his political start in the Democratic Party of the Left, the successor to the Italian Communist Party. Amongst the prominent 19th century revolutionaries produced by the region was a man called Andrea Costa, the first Italian parliamentary deputy elected on an explicitly socialist platform. Costa had another Romagnol colleague mustering votes for him in that election, a friend in whose house he stayed on at least one occasion, and who would give his firstborn son the middle name of Andrea in his honour, Alessandro Mussolini. Born in nearby Colina, which is just up the road from Predappio, on 11th of November 1854, Alessandro was a blacksmith and a fervent and convinced socialist who represented Predappio at the Congress of Socialist Groups of the region in 1876. In 1882, he married Rosa Maltoni, a schoolteacher, and in 1883 they had their first child, Benito Andrea Amilcare Mussolini, named after Andrea Costa, Amilcare Cipriani, who was another prominent socialist from the region, and Benito Juarez, the Mexican left-wing revolutionary. At the time of his birth, they were living in a tiny hamlet a little way down the hill from what was then Predappio, and the hamlet was called Dovia, home at the time only to an osteria, a small restaurant for travellers, a school in which Mussolini's mother taught and where the family lived, and a few houses. Shortly after gaining power in Italy in 1922, Benito Mussolini paid a much publicised visit to Dovia and to Predappio. And almost immediately afterwards, a deputation of local dignitaries went to see him in Rome to propose a plan of urban renewal for the area. Building work commenced in 1925 and went on until the late 30s, and Dovio was transformed from a backwater hamlet containing 180 odd people, a few houses and a single restaurant, into a monument to fascist urban planning, Predappio Nuova. It became host to the municipal headquarters of the Comune, that is it then and today. And this is the site of the schoolhouse in which Mussolini's mother taught and in which the family lived, to an impressively sized church in the main square, again then and now, to a hospital, a policeman's barracks, a post office, a primary and a secondary school, the local headquarters of the fascist youth movement and of its official trade union, a cinema, an aeroplane factory. Again, then and now, there was absolutely no strategic reason to build an aeroplane factory in the middle of the Apennine Mountains. So as soon as the war ended, it closed and is still now in ruins. And an associated flight testing facility, which is being used today. Extensive accommodation for associated workers and a flagship party headquarters for the Italian Fascist Party, also designed to host visiting dignitaries. The picture on the far right is from a postcard from the 1930s advertising Predappio, and that is it today. As you can see, the windows are smashed and it has plants growing out of its roof. It's been empty pretty much since the war. All of these are built in rationalist or monumentalist style, sometimes called of the Ventennio or simply fascist, and were designed by nationally prominent contemporary architects and urban planners such as Florestano Di Fausto. Once it was built, the regime paid for and organized tour group travel to Predappio Nuova so that people could admire the feats of its urban engineers as well as the humble origins of its Duce. Predappio became, in other words, a highly self-conscious and crucial aspect of the regime's myth-making apparatus. Mussolini himself paid frequent visits to the town, and Predappio's contemporary inhabitants of the right age bracket remember this, as well as visits from other dignitaries like the King of Italy. This is the king in the front center visiting the cemetery in which Mussolini's parents were buried. The village also, of course, benefited from all of this tourism, and Richard Bosworth, who is Mussolini's currently preeminent Anglophone biographer, cites a malicious historian who notes that by 1943, 334 Predappiesi relatives of Mussolini or his wife, Donna Rachele, had received government aid of some form or another. But all of this came to an end with the fall of fascism in 1943. Predappio was liberated by a Polish regiment fighting with the Allies on the 28th of October 1944, which is ironically also the anniversary of the fascist march on Rome. Writing 9 years later, fascist sympathizer Vittore Querel described it as the poorest and most abandoned, the saddest and most wretched town in all of Italy. The Caproni aeroplane factory, which I showed you a moment ago, closed and a great many jobs went with it. The flow of tourists also, of course, dried up, and the Comune's population dropped from a peak of around 11,000 down to its current levels of 6,000. Around 6,000. According to one local historian, archival reports suggest, though, that already by 1946, flowers and other offerings were being left at the tomb of Mussolini's parents in the cemetery of San Cassiano. That is the gate that you can see in the background there, seen from the front today, which was also rebuilt in more imposing style and to give the Mussolini family crypt pride of place. And at this time in 1946, Mussolini's body was hidden in a Milanese cemetery before it was stolen by neo-fascists and then recovered by the state and hidden in a Capuchin convent. Then in 1957, Adonizzoli of the dominant centre-right Christian Democratic Party became Italy's prime minister. He led a minority government which, it soon became clear, would for the first time in Italy's post-war history have to rely on a sort of confidence and supply agreement with the new incarnation of Italy's fascist party, then called the Italian Social Movement, the MSI. He also, in fact, was another native of Predappio. His family owned the estate on which Mussolini's wife was born. So Predappiesi are very proud of the fact that they have produced two prime ministers from this tiny, tiny place. Although it would last little more than a year, one aspect of the agreement with the MSI was that Mussolini's body, which at the time was hidden in this convent, would be returned to the family and interred in their crypt. Zoli is alleged to have telephoned the then mayor of Predappio to ask for his blessing for this transfer, and the response he received, which is constantly quoted by contemporary Predappiesi, was apparently, "Mussolini didn't scare us when he was alive, and he won't scare us now that he's dead." The body was reburied in San Cassiano on August 31st, 1957. But accompanying it were 3,500 neo-fascists, and the very next weekend another 7,000 turned up. When told by police that they weren't allowed to wear fascist uniforms, they took them off, resulting in a cemetery temporarily full of semi-naked men. And since 1957, Predappio tends to attract around 80 to 100,000 so-called black tourists a year. 3 days in particular involve commemorative marches, speeches and festivities, the anniversaries of Mussolini's birth and death, and the anniversary of the March on Rome, two of which are somewhat inconvenient because the anniversary of the March on Rome, as I mentioned earlier, also falls on the anniversary of Predappio's liberation, and the anniversary of Mussolini's death also falls more or less on the National Day of Liberation for Italy. So Mussolini may or may not scare contemporary Predappiesi since his death, but he certainly had a very profound effect indeed on their lives. Visiting Predappio today is a remarkable experience. For some, the village is the equivalent of a toxic waste dump, or the Chernobyl of history, as the mayor puts it, a symbol of and repository for all that is shameful in recent Italian history. Architecturally speaking, it is utterly dominated by the style of the Ventennio. The main square is overlooked by the imposing church of St. Anthony, on whose facade is inscribed the date of completion. You can just about see it at the top underneath the name of the church. The date of completion in the EF, or Era Fascista. The old hospital on its right-hand side on the same square still has a fasces embedded in one of two decorative orifices. And across the square is the former Casa del Fascio, the party headquarters, topped by an unmistakably phallic bell tower and now desolate and in ruins. And it's in this building that the Museum of Fascism is supposedly to be installed. But for now, pigeons roost in its eaves and rubble and dust dominate its interior. And meanwhile, the mayor sits at Mussolini's old writing desk, salvaged from his summer retreat. A walk in one direction from this main square down what was once called Corso Benito Mussolini and is now renamed after the most famous victim of fascism, Giacomo Matteotti, will lead you past three shops which sell what are euphemistically referred to as souvenirs. T-shirts and babies' bibs with fascist slogans printed on them, copies of Mein Kampf, busts of Mussolini, war medals, and even manganelli, the clubs with which fascist squads would beat their political opponents. The vendors insist that they will break if you try to hit anything or anyone with them. Across the street from the house in which Mussolini was born, which is now an exhibition space, is the Osteria, which dates back to the time of Dovia, in which one can purchase bottles of wine with Mussolini's visage printed on the labels. Leaving that main square in the opposite direction will take you to the cemetery of San Cassiano, which houses the remains of family members for most contemporary Predappiesi, as well as those of the Mussolini family. And of course, it's for the latter reason that one is likely to be asked for directions to it by visitors. And it's the Mussolini crypt that's the first thing that one sees upon entering the cemetery at the end of the path, which begins at the cemetery gates. Entering the crypt, descending down a flight of stone stairs, one emerges in a small subterranean chamber in which the remains of Mussolini's wife, parents, children, and some kinsmen and affines are entombed in stone sarcophagi, in a number of cases topped by marble busts or photographs. In the centre is Mussolini's tomb and a large bust of the man himself, gazing out over a visitor's book in which are inscribed, by my average count, 30 to 40 new messages a day, most of which are variations on a theme of come back to us, Luce. Passing through the crypt and ascending by another staircase, one is faced with several walls covered almost entirely in plaques donated by neo-fascist organisations commemorating a particular visit to the tomb or the passing of a member. For its black-shirted visitors, in other words, Predappio, far from being a toxic waste dump of history, is symbolic of a history Italy should remember with pride. Those who don't respect the past cannot govern the present, read one banner at an anniversary march I witnessed. On that same march, that is a group gathered just outside the church, I observed a small group of men of varying ages wearing black fascist military uniforms, led by a man of middle age. As the troop neared the mausoleum, its leader called out to the members of the group to begin marching in military step. After a brief hesitation, a young man towards the rear of the group began to goose step before being instantly reprimanded by the troop leader. No, he said, that's their thing, that's the Germans' thing. We're fascists, not Nazis. And I was reminded of that minor display of technical discrimination a little later on the same day as I stood on the street with some anti-fascists who'd come to Predappio to witness the extent of the turnout. As we stood and watched individuals and groups of people pass by, many of whom were returning to town from the mausoleum on foot and by car, one of my companions began reeling off ostensive definitions of her own. That one's fascist, that one too, probably that one as well, that one might not be, that one's from here, I think. And I asked how she was able to tell who was a fascist and who wasn't, and she listed some indexical signs. Black clothing, not an essential criterion though, because anarchists wear black too. Leather, also not an essential criterion. Having a shaven head, also not an essential criterion, a fact for which I am personally grateful. Origin of car license plate. And an old friend later gave me another example of a comparable definitional practice from the 70s, one adopted by local leftist militants who would go to Predappio in search of visiting fascists to attack. So what they'd do is they'd place a volunteer by the side of the road who would wait for a coachload of visitors to come past. When the coach passed, he would raise his arm and give the Roman salute. If the people on the coach raised their arms and gave the Roman salute back, he would signal his friends at the top of the hill, who would start dropping boulders on the coach from above. Debates, in other words, over how to define fascism, are an unavoidable aspect of life in contemporary Predappio. They take place over architecture. Is a building fascist because it possesses certain design features, even when those features are also present in other buildings elsewhere in the world, the University Library in Cambridge, for instance? Or is it fascist because it was designed by an architect who held a party membership card, even though he is also believed to have harboured anti-fascist convictions? They take place over commerce and economy. How much fascist paraphernalia, need be present in a place of business to make it fascist? Must the entire locale be devoted to the sale of memorabilia, or is a restaurant fascist because it stocks Predappio's famous wine? How many fascist clients serve to make for a fascist business? Of course, those debates take place over individuals all the time, and they take place on a macro scale over Predappio itself, which to many outsiders is forever tainted by the historical fact of being the place of Mussolini's birth. Recall the author of the anonymous postcards to the mayor, and similarly prominent intellectual from Marxist intellectual from Bologna, who's been extremely vocal in opposition to Predappio's museum project, put it to me like this: the whole town is the Duce's tomb, and since 1957 that place is completely defined by fascism. Meanwhile, Predappiesi remind everybody that they possibly can that Predappio has always elected left-wing mayors. So we might, of course, respond to such a proliferation of definitional positions by taking the view, seemingly above the fray, that fascism is a family resemblance term or a polythetic category. And there are people in Predappio who adopt variations of that sort of position. If you take the story of the pre-fascist mayor with which I began this paper and his multiple shifts of allegiance, we might hear in that story evidence for the fascism as family resemblance hypothesis. Definitions are fuzzy by nature, and this man's repeated and seemingly genuine changes of heart make it clear how pointless it would be to try to point to someone or something and declare it to be essentially fascist. Indeed, that's not at all dissimilar to the spin that Predappio's mayor Frassinetti likes to put on the story. Such an anti-definitional position has certain consequences, of which Frassinetti very much approves. It turns what many of a more ideological bent would prefer to see as a black and white issue into a grey area. And it's also worth noting that such an interpretation of the story misses something of what makes it so compelling to many others in Predappio. It isn't compelling to them because it mixes black and white, or red in this case, into grey, but for precisely the opposite reason. The man in the story is not, for them, a murky admixture of socialist and fascist. He was a socialist, and then he was a fascist, and then he was a socialist again. It's precisely the definitive and determining nature of those attributes that makes his switches between them worth relating in the story. Defining categories allows people and places not only to fall within them, but also to fall out of them, a point Melford Spiro has made of our own anthropological categories. My suggestion instead for how we account for the persistence of definitional arguments over the nature of fascism is twofold. This is the first part. My suggestion is that pace echo, there is another and more appropriate concept from the philosophy of language with which to explain the persistence of this question than that of family resemblance, and that is the notion of a rigid designator. Originating in the work of post, and at least in some sense anti-Wittgensteinian philosopher Saul Kripke, a rigid designator is a word that's used with what Hilary Putnam calls an indexical intention, in that it's designed to persistently pick out the same sort of object regardless of the knowledge the user has about the nature of that object. The paradigm case is the way we tend to use proper names. So if I say Nixon was the President of the United States, then I use the word Nixon intending to pick out one and only one particular object in the world, and I attribute to that object a description. Was the President of the United States. But if I similarly say Nixon may not have been the President of the United States, my intention is to speak about a possible world in which that description is not true, but the object is the same. The whole point of my use of the word Nixon is to pick out the same object in a different sort of situation. I use the name, in other words, to rigidly designate the same object, no matter what else may change about it. That's also often the case with very clearly indexical terms, like pronouns, you, he, she, and words like now, today, yesterday, which are usually not used as, even though they can be read as, disguised descriptions. The issue of users' actual knowledge of the nature of an object enters into the matter much more clearly when we consider the rigid manner in which natural kind terms are also often used, according to this line of argument. So Kripke's famous example is the nature of water as composed of H2O molecules. He and Putnam both point out that when we call an object water, what we usually intend to mean by that term is that it's a liquid composed of H2O molecules. If I point to what I think is water, what looks like water, what I might assume, given the context, to be water, call it water and drink it and discover that it's vodka, I will be surprised, pleasantly or otherwise, and I will also likely think of my earlier act of naming as mistaken. But exactly the same is likely also true if the liquid in question is in all respects akin to water, except for not being composed of H2O molecules. If I give it to a chemist and the chemist tells me the liquid is not so composed, I will likely similarly regard my earlier act of naming it as water to be mistaken. And the differences between those two examples already suggest some of the sociolinguistic implications of the concept of rigid designation. Apart from the difference in my capacity to understand arguments about rigid designation that would ensue if I drank a glass of vodka as opposed to a glass of almost but not quite water, the crucial difference is that in the second and more testing case, I need the help of an expert to resolve any doubts I have as to whether or not I've correctly designated the liquid in question. So the implication of the notion of rigid designation, in other words, is a sociolinguistic division of labour in which some people, experts of some sort, have attributed to them the capacity to determine correct usage. And my suggestion here, broadly speaking, is that often when people in Predapio, and perhaps more broadly elsewhere, use the term fascist, they are using it as if it were a rigid designator. That is, they intend precisely not to use it as a family resemblance term, but as a term that will constantly, consistently pick out the same sort of object. That helps, I think, in narrowing down the problem somewhat, in that it provides us with a vocabulary to describe how people use the word in such a way that it seems to demand a definition. It helps to answer the question of why one might think that the question, what is fascism, should have an answer. But it doesn't yet answer the question of why we might, or Predapiesi might, argue over what that answer should be. To help answer this latter question, I'll move from the general conceptual terrain of rigid designation to what it's possible to understand as a particular form of it, before returning to the notion of a sociolinguistic division of labour. The 12th disposition of the post-war Italian constitution forbids the reorganisation under any form whatsoever of, quote, the dissolved Italian fascist party. That disposition was clarified and extended in a later law known as the Scelba Law, and both of those interventions also built on the practice of the Allied military government in Italy and its Italian civilian successor, both of which distributed questionnaires to civil servants, schede personale, which listed, for instance, 43 categories of questions trying to determine from respondents exactly how deeply they were involved in fascist activity and thus who ought to be prosecuted by tribunals as a fascist. In other words, fascism and fascist were, and de jure, if not de facto, still are, legal categories like theft, murder, arson, and so on. They form a species of rigid designation. So when we use words like theft, murder, or arson, often we do so as intending to use them to designate only certain special sorts of acts. And if we discover that they don't, we'll be often content to retrospectively correct our usage. So newspapers refer to alleged crimes until those crimes have been proven in court, and we habitually refer to joyriding, for instance, in everyday parlance, when discussing the crime of taking a car for the purpose of cruising around in it rather than depriving the owner of it, even if we may not be completely aware of the technical legal distinction between the two. As Paul Dresch has put it in regard to the importance of categories in legalistic thinking, one has to have an idea of, for instance, kinsmen and of what they should do as distinct from experience of my particular brother or cousin before one can complain of them not doing it. legalism makes such categories explicit. What I'm suggesting, in other words, slightly more quickly than I'd like to, is that a candidate explanation for why Predappiesi used the word fascist as a rigid designator is that it has a historic existence as a legal term of art, which a court or an allied questionnaire employed definitively to describe someone in a manner that would stick rigidly. Now, one might extend that potentially into a broader discussion of the heritage of the Nuremberg, Frankfurt and Eichmann trials in the wider Euro-American imaginary, but I'm going to confine myself to Predappio and the Italian context. Now, very quickly, in light of all this talk of legality, one might well ask how it can then be the case that in Predappio one can buy babies' bibs with fascist slogans written on them and witness regular public demonstrations of people who openly declare themselves to be fascist and carry fascist symbols and assorted paraphernalia. And more broadly, one might also ask, as I've done already, why, if fascism may be helpfully thought of as a rigidly designating legal term akin to theft or murder, do people argue so regularly over its meaning in a way they don't usually do over whether or not to call a man standing over a dead body with a smoking gun a murderer? And there are, I think, two answers to that question, one very specific and one more general. The specific answer reinforces the argument that fascism is used rigidly when used legally. Though any student of post-war Italian history knows that since 1945, there have existed any number of what many, though not all, people would consider to be reincarnations of the Italian Fascist Party, indeed the most mainstream recent version of which just won 4.4% of the vote in the last general election. But several Italian courts over the years have issued a number of decisions which very much restrict the scope of the application of the Constitution and the Scelba law in this matter. And some of those decisions are particularly interesting because they've had the effect of determining that because the article of the Constitution refers to the dissolved Italian Fascist Party, what it criminalises is not any particular set of ideas or practices which we might commonsensically think of as fascist, but rather the specific object in the world that was the dissolved Italian Fascist Party and certain attitudes to it. That's a paradigmatic case of rigid designation, and the effect of it, for instance, is that there's virtually nothing in the world today that one can point to and say that is fascist and be legally correct. And the second, a much more general answer, is a failure of application. I've heard of only one case in Predappio's recent history of a prosecution related to fascist demonstrations, and that was for a fray rather than for apologia, which is the name of the crime the Scelba law criminalises. It's also more generally true that the Scelba law has been very rarely applied in Italy, so even though it may be the case that the rigid use of the term fascism originates in a conception or imaginary of it as a criminal category, many people will laugh if you ask them why those they label as fascist are not then prosecuted for being so by the courts. So, to return to the problem of why, given the existence of the conviction that the question, what is fascism, has an answer, why did there also exist endless arguments as to what that answer is? Despite the fact that fascism is often used rigidly, there is no serious equivalent in its case to the chemist who would test my water for H2O. In other words, it's used as if it should have a proper meaning, I suspect in part because of its once real, even if now only nominal, existence as a legal term, but because that existence is now largely nominal, there is no longer any serious authority to whom one can defer judgment as to the nature of this proper meaning. And when legal authorities do make themselves manifest, they do so, for instance, by so restricting the extension of the term that it may only apply to the historical entity that was the dissolved Italian Fascist Party. So I will rush swiftly through my conclusion. So I don't suggest that that's the only potential explanation for the persistence of the problem, what is fascism, and its framing in the way that I've described. One obviously self-evidently related explanation is that the term carries a great deal of moral weight. People who use it intend to designate something that they view with a considerable degree of worry, gravity, and antipathy, and they want to know exactly what it is that they're worrying about. Of course, those explanations aren't mutually exclusive, though. A great many legal terms are also morally laden. Think of cruel in the Eighth Amendment to the US Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. Some legal scholars, like Ronald Dworkin, have read those as a sort of moral natural kinds, which are intended to pick out repeatedly the same sort of action. Also, more broadly, it's obviously true that part of the reason for why morally laden terms become legal terms is that we worry about their precise meaning. I've also suggested that one reason for which the question, what is fascism, appears unanswerable, despite a persistent desire for such an answer, is that though it's often treated as if it ought to be a legal or moral natural kind, no expert exists to determine correctly rigid usage, and the want of such experts is, I suspect, also behind the desire on the part of journalists to get academic historians to tell them whether or not Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen count as fascist. I should also say that obviously not everybody in Predapio uses the word in the manner in which I've been describing. So some people, such as Frassinetti, for instance, the mayor, use it without the same level of moral valence, and they do so almost as we might use the words table or chair, without the expectation that such usage will pick out one particular nature or property. In a very brief conclusion, I suggest that both sorts of usage have their own sorts of effects of which we may or may not wish to approve. Thinking of fascism as a rigid designator or a moral natural kind has the advantage of allowing us to point at specific people and things and declare them to be such, with all the consequences thus entailed. And this was, of course, what actually occurred during the denazification and defascistization processes in Italy and Germany after the war, albeit not sufficiently thoroughly, in the opinion of many. That advantage, though, of course, is reduced in the absence of agreement about what it is that makes someone or something an example of a fascist, and in the absence of an authority to adjudicate on competing meanings. But it's also worth pointing out that a part of the reason for which some people have been and are dissatisfied with, for instance, the defascistization process in Italy, and thus part of the reason for why people in black shirts continue to march down the streets of Predapio, even though those streets have their own new designators, is that they find it hard to believe that fascism as a phenomenon was simply a collection of people possessed of a particular characteristic or trait, and that disposing of enough of those people disposes of fascism. Though that latter view has had its advocates. A variant of that position was put forward by Benedetto Croce, a famous Italian philosopher and member of the Liberal Party, who was at pains to counter, for instance, Marxist definitions of fascism as a class-based phenomenon. For Croce, instead, it was a form of civic depression. It could affect any individual in a manner akin to a sickness, a moral disease, or indeed a natural kind. It was also an international phenomenon, according to Croce, unrelated entirely to any systematic cultural or social issues in Italian life, and hence could be defined, as he put it, as a parenthesis in the history of the country. And that definition was effectively that which the Italian state adopted in the aftermath of the war, and as a consequence, many have argued, defascistization was largely ineffective in its results. And it allowed for the persistence of the implication that people woke up one day in 1922 as fascists and on another day in 1943 as liberals. A variant of that view is perhaps also responsible for the apparent surprise with which each new electoral success or demonstration by the far right is greeted today. That surprise perhaps regards the fact that more people have been infected with what is understood to be a moral disease, that more people have acquired whatever property we see as underlying it, and who therefore must be quarantined, punished, or otherwise treated for it. Such a view, it's perhaps worth noting, is one that treats a complex political, cultural, and social phenomenon as reducible to a definition, and then attachable to individual people, regardless of subtleties or variations in any other characteristics they possess, deemed irrelevant to the definition, as if indeed they were on trial. If fascism was indeed merely a parenthesis in Italian history, albeit one that may have recently reopened, Predappio has always existed within it. And if in Europe and America more broadly, we are once more pondering Orwell's unanswered question of our time, for Predappiesi the importance of that question has never receded. I haven't tried to answer it for you today, but I have, I hope, conveyed some reasons why it might appear to matter to them and to others quite so much. Thank you.